Whose idea was it to think that an octopus could predict soccer games? Don't know about that one. Seems a little odd to me. From my experience, octopi are good at two things: garlic and lemon juice. Apart from that, can't see a lot of use to an octopus, particularly when it comes to events of a sporting nature. And I've got a theory about Hollywood. My theory about Hollywood is this: it's insane. I was once in Hollywood about 12 years ago, and a hippie cab driver told me that the problem with Hollywood is there's not enough oxygen. The pollution in the air means there's not enough oxygen, so everyone's slightly suffering from anoxia. They're not getting enough to their brains. Unless you're way up in the hills, you're just not getting enough for you to think clearly. And also the lead pollution, all of the petrochemicals, all of the other bits of pollution that are in there, mean that the people making decisions about movies that we see are basically, and this is sad, and it really is to be pitied more than angry about, they're suffering from brain damage. So I think that you get more from Hollywood movies if you just take into account the simple fact that the people making the decisions, including some of the writers and the script writers and the producers and the directors and the people who select the music and the people who make their lunches, are all suffering from some level of brain damage. Once you come to terms with that simple, irrevocable fact, I think you can really understand Hollywood well. My name is Terry Frost, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 55.
Cinema Podcast is a three-weekly podcast that looks at cinema between 1895 and 1990. We look at cult films, science fiction, action movies, foreign language films, and anything else that might be interesting. The voicemail phone number is 206-666-4886. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The podcast website is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast may contain adult content, so if you're under 18, don't let your parents catch you listening to it.
I should let you know, guys, we also have another means by which you can give feedback to the podcast. I now have voicemail on Skype. So if you go to Paleo Cinema, lowercase no dash, so PaleoCinema. If I'm not on there, you can leave a voicemail. So I've forked out for that. And hopefully it'll make it a little bit easier for some people to give feedback wherever you are on this clay and granite planet. So what have I been watching? Been watching a few things. I did get some free movie tickets, which had to be used by the end of last month. So I watched a couple of things. I'm just going to get my notes up here. Saw the A-Team movie. I was never a fantastically big fan of the A-Team on television in the early days. I thought it was very much a Formula 8 kind of thing. Yes, Mr. T was a unique character in television, but I kind of thought it was a bit white bread and weak in a way. It was very much formulaic 1980s television, and the agendas were being set by pretty much by the censors at that stage, as they indeed are in a lot of television. So I was never really in love with it. It was kind of middle of the road, and I was at that stage watching a lot of exploitation films, which were a lot more visceral in a lot of ways and a lot more graphic. So the attraction of the A-Team really wasn't something that I tapped into at all. The movie's an okay action film. I'm not going to really knock it for that. It's exactly what you expect it to be. You know, lots of big explosions, lots of one-liners, lots of silliness, and not to be taken seriously. I think it suffers in comparison to another recent film, very, very similar, The Losers, the one that I talked about a couple of podcasts ago that I saw. Very much, if you're going to have a toss a coin and see which one of the two movies you're going to see, pick The Losers. Jeffrey Dean Morgan's much better than Liam Neeson, and very similar, but a lot. It's got a lot more meat to it. I mean, one's thin soup, the other one's a nice thick stew, so give that a go. I did see Toy Story 3 as well. Saw it with a friend and her son, and it works, kind of. I thought that it was a bit manipulative towards the end. I've said this before. I don't know whether I've said it on the podcast, but I have said it before in real life. I don't mind a movie seducing me. Got no problem with that at all. I can buy in. I can be fully a part of things. I don't mind at all a movie sucking me into its world and seducing me. I do object when it jams its hand down my front pocket and starts fiddling. And I think that Toy Story 3 does that. It's a little bit obvious in the manipulation. It's really something that that I found a bit of a problem for me. So, I mean, don't let that stop you from going and seeing it. I'm sure a lot of people are, and I'm sure a lot of people got kids, and the kids will definitely enjoy it. It's very much along those lines. But for me, it kind of didn't work for that reason. Now, what else? I saw Predators. I did see the new kind of reboot of the Predator franchise, harking back to the 1987 Johnny Tiernan directed Arnie Schwarzenegger movie, and this time starring Adrian Brody, Danny Trejo, and a bunch of other people, Topher Grace. And yeah, it works. This one, you know, it's an action film, as was the A-Team, but this one kind of really worked much better because, yeah, there was a little bit of humour in a couple of places, but it really did deliver the goods. The predators are nasty. The people who are hunted by the predators are, in their own way, at least as nasty as the predators are. Yes, it functions as it should do. And it's probably one of the better action films I've seen this year, so I'll recommend that. I did see an Australian movie, a recent one, maybe a little hard to access, but you may be able to find it by some means. It's called Stone Brothers. It's about a couple of Indigenous cousins, so Aboriginal in other words, who basically go on a road trip to deliver some sacred stones to an uncle of theirs, and it's a kind of really nice road comedy slash family drama slash Indigenous Australian story. The director of it, Richard Franklin, is an Indigenous Australian. The actors in it, for the most part, are, with a couple of exceptions, and I've had quite a moving film. It's got some funny bits. There's a possessed dog, which is one of those little kind of Paris Hilton sit-in-your-purse dogs, which gets possessed by evil spirits after a curse is laid. And there's some kind of Indigenous magic kind of stuff going on there. It's got a touch of that magic realism, which is quite funny. And if you want to learn more about Indigenous culture, you could do worse than seeing Stone Brothers. And maybe I think it's very accessible. I don't think there's going to be particularly a problem for people who have no background knowledge in Australian Indigenous culture to enjoy. It's a 2009 film. Saw it on cable, and I very much like it. I thought that it was well done, low budget, but it's got a generosity of spirit that I really enjoyed. So it's probably one of the better movies I've seen this year, in fact. Now, I've been watching a bit of television as well. I've been watching the new season of The IT Crowd, being a computer slash everything else geek. Definitely getting into that. It's hilariously funny. They do a tremendously good piss take on Scientology, which is always something that I'm going to have time for. And again, the ensemble acting is pretty good. Been watching True Blood as well. There's always a bit of fun with the vampires and the werewolves and the nudity and the violence and that kind of thing. But watch the first two episodes of the new season of Eureka, which is another show that I enjoy watching. And I did see another kind of giant bug movie called Infestation. It's kind of low budget, doesn't have anyone famous in it, but it's kind of, apart from Ray Wise, who you might remember from Twin Peaks. Yeah, that basically people wake up covered in, they're cocooned up, and then wake up and find out that where they live has been taken over by giant black bugs. There's a lot of kind of, you know, bug gore in it, and a lot of interesting twists and turns. Not a large budget, a lot of CGI use, some model work and some prosthesis, but it wasn't tremendously over the top fantastic, but it is definitely worth having a go at while you're in the video store. Watch a bunch of other things. Look, I've got this kind of weird new addiction, and it's not as bad as you think. The weird new addiction is to watching trailer compilations, so, you know, like exploitation and grindhouse trailer compilations. Pick them up from a few of the usual suspects and just sit there having them on TV while I'm doing other things, and occasionally jotting down the names of movies to see if I can find them, if they have particularly interesting trailers. So if you're into exploitation cinema, I recommend getting hold of some grindhouse trailers compilations. There's a 42nd Street Forever series of them. There's another thing called Grindhouse something or other, I've forgotten what it's called, but look around, you'll find them, and they're always a bit of fun if you don't want to. It's kind of like reading short stories. You can dip into them and then stop watching them and then go in and watch some more. So I've been doing a bit of that. Now, nothing else much happening around here. It's still winter, which is, as you know, I don't particularly like. And Australia has a federal election. Our new female Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, who looks a little bit like Tilda Swinton, has called an election going up against the mad monk Tony Abbott, who is the conservative side of politics and does triathlons and thinks that women should stay in the household and basically wants to live a 1950s lifestyle for everybody except himself. But that's my bias showing. So we've got a federal election coming up in August. All the bells and whistles there. I'm also a bit of a political wonk, so I'm enjoying the circus of that. And speaking of circuses, I've got a segue there. One of the films I'm going to talk about today is The Big Carnival, also known as Ace in the Hole, starring Kirk Douglas, Jan Sterling. And the other film I'm going to talk about is a 1971 British crime drama called Villain, starring Richard Burton, Ian McShane, Joss Ackland, Nigel Davenport, and a few other people. So that's what I'm going to be talking about this time around. I'm going to take a little bit of a break now and then get into the first of the two films. And I think I'll talk about Ace in the Hole / The Big Carnival, directed by Billy Wilder.
Life today is hectic. Our world is running away. Only the wise can recognize the process of decay. Unhappily, all our dialectic is quite unable to say whether we're on the beam or not, whether we rise supreme or not, whether this new regime or not is leading us astray. We all have frigidaires, radios, television and movie shows to shield us from the ultimate abyss. We have our daily bread, neatly cut, every modern convenience, but the question that confronts us all is this. What's going to happen to the children when there aren't any more grown-ups? Having been injected with some rather peculiar glands, darling mum's gone platinum and dances to all the rumba bands. The songs that she sings at twilight would certainly be the highlight for some of those clacks that Elsa Maxwell takes around in yachts. Rock-a-bye, 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 my darlings. Mother requires a few more shots. Does it amuse the tiny mites to see their parents high as kites? What's going to happen to the tots? Life today's neurotic, a ceaseless battle we wage. Millions are spent to circumvent the march of middle age. The fact that we grab each new narcotic can only prove in the end whether our hormones gel or not, whether our cells rebel or not, whether we're blown to hell or not, we'll all be round the bend from taking Benzedrine, Dexamil, every possible sleeping pill to knock us out or knock us into shape. We all have shots for this, shots for that, shots for making us thin or fat. But there's one problem that we can't escape. What's going to happen to the children when there aren't any more grown-ups? Thanks to plastic surgery and Uncle's abrupt demise, dear Aunt Rose has changed her nose but doesn't appear to realise that pleasures that once were heaven look silly at 67. And youthful allure you can't procure in terms of perms and pots. So lullaby, 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 my darlings, try not to scratch those large red spots. Think of the shock when Mummy's face is lifted from its proper place. What's going to happen to the tots? What's going to happen to the children when there aren't any more grown-ups? It's bizarre when Grandmama, without getting out of breath, starts to jive at 85 and frightens the little ones to death. The police had to send a squad car when Daddy got fried on vodka and tied a tweed coat round Mummy's throat in several sailor's knots. Hush-a-bye, 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 my darlings, try not to fret and wet your cots. One day you'll clench your tiny fists and murder your psychiatrists. What's going to happen to the tots?
That was that famous 20th century raconteur and social commentator Noel Coward with What's Going to Happen to Them Children. Just thought I'd throw that in because it seems to be quite an interesting viewpoint and one that's not entirely lost when we look at the 21st century. So, on to the movies. First one, as I said, is going to be Ace in the Hole. The studio, Paramount, I believe it was, changed the title to The Big Carnival for really no good reason. I think they're both good titles. I don't think it's really a big problem that the title was changed. It was the first movie that Billy Wilder made after he broke up with his long-term collaborator, Charles Bracker, with whom he worked on The Lost Weekend and Sunset Boulevard, amongst other films. But it was really Wilder's first film that was a critical and commercial failure. Now, I have done my homework on this film. And I'm reading from the Ragman son Kirk Douglas's autobiography, basically I'm going to paraphrase from it rather than read from it. He said that there were the big problem and the reason why there was such negative criticism of this film. Actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me do a précis first, then I'll tell you why there was so much critical response to the film. Okay, Chuck Tatum, a fiercely ambitious, self-centered, wisecracking down on his luck reporter who has worked his way down the ladder. He came west to New Mexico from New York City, along with being fired from 11 newspapers for slander, adultery, and heavy drinking, amongst other charges. Now that his car has broken down and Tatum is broke, he talks his way into a reporting job for the Albuquerque Sun Bulletin, a kind of minor small-town newspaper. Tatum stays sober and works there for a year for an editor called Boot. And then while unhappy on an assignment covering a rattlesnake hunt, he learns about Leo Mendoza, a local man who has become trapped in a cave collapse while trying to excavate ancient Indian artifacts. Sensing a golden opportunity, Tatum manipulates the rescuer for convincing an unscrupulous sheriff to pressure the engineer charged with the rescue into using a much slower method so that Tatum can prolong his stay on the front pages of newspapers nationwide. That's pretty much it. Now, the reason why there was so much negative press about Ace in the Hole / The Big Carnival was this. Newspapers were the main people writing criticism of movies, and there was a perceived negativity about the fact that the protagonist of this particular film was a sleazy, corrupt journalist. So they weren't particularly happy about that. This is Kirk Douglas's slant on it anyway. That's what he thinks is the reason why it got such negative publicity. It has since then recovered from that. It's one of those movies with a long tail because there was a Criterion edition put out a few years ago, and Criterion doesn't tend to do movies that are of no value. And I first saw this film, again, as I saw many films, late at night on free-to-air television, just looking for something to watch, and suddenly this film came on with these desert landscapes and incredibly sleazy characters, and I fell in love with it to a big extent. I'm actually surprised that I haven't dealt with this on a previous Paleo Cinema podcast. This is one of those great film noirs that doesn't have a normal film noir setting of kind of rain-swept streets in the city at night time. This one's set in the New Mexico desert on a hill where there are adobe cliff dwellings, and it kicks ass. It's dark, it's nasty. There's only perhaps one character in the whole film that isn't a total bastard, that being the newspaper editor, Mr. Boots, played by Porter Hall. It's actually an interesting role for Porter Hall. He usually plays kind of characters who are slightly weak, but I think in this one he doesn't do that. He plays a character with a little bit of backbone to him, which is nice to see, a kind of change of pace for a character actor who was in a lot of films doing small things and then suddenly does this one. And Kirk Douglas is great in it. Jan Sterling is great. Douglas has, of course, always been an actor who paints his characters in broad strokes. There's not a lot of nuance there. It's all, even when he is nuanced, there are wide streaks of nuance, if you know what I mean. And he kind of brings what's necessary to the character of Tatum, and that kind of self-destructive but worldly guy looking for his chance to get out of the rut that he dug himself into, and to take the easy opportunity rather than the more difficult one of really kind of doing the hard yards, in a sense. I'm sure that, I mean, looking at the price of the movie, the guy's been in Albuquerque, New Mexico for 12 months, and I'm sure a really top journalist would be able to find a way to find a story of meaning and depth in that 12 months. But what Tatum was doing is looking for the sensational thing. He's looking for the big wow. And he gets it. Now, here's what Douglas says about this. I'm going to talk about this movie at length because there's quite a bit of it to talk about. Yeah, Douglas basically went up to Billy Wilder and said, and here's Douglas talking, "I thought the character I played in Ace in the Hole was too rough. Billy, don't you think I should come on a little softer, a little more charming, to make him sympathetic, to make the audience care about him?" But he said, "Give it both knees right from the beginning." And Douglas did. So basically, Douglas wanted to go soft because, of course, he came out of the studio system. He was still in the studio system at the time. And he wasn't quite at the stage of his career where he was willing to do an unvarnished bastard. But Billy Wilder wanted that. He really knew what he wanted. He went with it. And, of course, it is one of Douglas's better roles. I'll just play some audio from the film. There are a couple of good lines I want to chuck in here. And then I'll talk about some more of the this film, which is really a condemnation of the kind of journalism that's come to the forefront in our own age. I'll play you a bit from the trailer first. It's a little bombastic, and it's a typical studio trailer from the 1950s, but then I'll play a couple of the really cool little bits from the movie itself.
Trapped by a cave-in, and from every part of a shocked and anxious nation, the crowd streamed to watch the desperate rescue crews fighting against time, battering their way to the barrier of solid rock, while far below, a daring reporter makes his way into the treacherous, crumbling tunnel that is the only lifeline between the helpless victim and the outside world.
You'll be out of here by tomorrow morning.
No, I won't. He'll never reach me by tomorrow morning.
You'll be out of here in 12 hours. Hang on!
Kirk Douglas has his greatest role as the reporter who would do anything for a story. Jan Sterling becomes a star of the first rank as the not-so-heartbroken wife of the man buried beneath the mountain.
Maybe we'll have a couple of drinks. Maybe you'll even take me out for a big evening, huh?
Why don't you wash that platinum out of your hair?
Phony, below-the-belt journalism, that's what it is.
Not below the belt, right in the gut, Mr. Boot.
Human interest.
Nothing you've ever seen before has the tremendous human interest of Ace in the Hole. For here is a startling story of human emotions and human desires played against the most exciting fight to save a man's life ever depicted on the screen.
Now, when Smollett comes, you can give him your orders. Tell him to go in through the cliff dwelling, shore it up, and get him out fast.
Not through the cliff dwelling. You can't get him out that way anymore.
Now, here's a bit of the dialogue itself. There's some really cool film noir one-liners in this film, and I want to kind of share a couple of them with you. First one's between Jan Sterling and talking about the Kirk Douglas Chuck Tatum character.
I met a lot of hard-boiled eggs in my life, but you're 20 minutes.
And the next one's where Tatum's giving Mrs. Minoza, I think her name's Lorraine, instructions on what to do with the media around while her husband's trapped underneath this mountain.
Look, Mrs. Minoza, they're having a rosary at that little church this evening. I want you to be there.
I don't go to church. Kneeling bags my nylons.
So she is as hard-boiled a character as he is. And that, of course, leads to Tatum's undoing in some ways. I'm not going to do spoilers on the end of the film, but it's very solid, and Jan Sterling's got an incredibly uncompromising character. She was an actress who was actually born from quite wealthy parents, but she had a career playing women who maybe were from the wrong side of the tracks, and she did get an Academy Award nomination for a film called The High and the Mighty in 1954, soon after this film was made. Best Supporting Actress nomination. She didn't win, but I think that she was a fine actress, and particularly in this film, she kind of went where the role needed to take her. And she's one of the women characters in cinema that really has no softness to her at all. She married her husband after the war when he came back from Europe. After he was a soldier during World War II, and moved out to the desert from New York with him, and life kind of didn't go the way she wanted it to go, and she sees her life kind of drifting away from her to an extent, and is looking for a chance to get out. So she does that incredibly well. It's just one of those uncompromising female roles. It reminds me a bit of Anne Savage's role in Detour, the 1945 film. She's got that kind of hard-boiled female character where it kind of goes against the zeitgeist of the 1950s, where women were seen as homemakers and nurturers and things like that. And there was a particular kind of female character that appeared in film noir that really played against that stereotype of human beings. So the thing is, as this story leaks in the film, I'm digressing, but as the story leaks in the film, people start crowding around the site where this poor man is trapped underground, and start coming in with their caravans and their Airstream trailers and flooding in from every direction. And basically that's where the big carnival comes from. It is the absolute crystal sharp definition of a media circus, because there are carnival rides, there's a circus there, there's a Ferris wheel, there's everything kind of coalesces around this story as Chuck Tatum, and of course as the journalists around the country, get hold of the story and get hold of the human interest story. And there's playing up the idea that there's a Native American curse on the site and that kind of thing, all those media beat up kind of ideas that came into play on this story that really is kind of gripping the nation in a sense. And there's even a really sick kind of hillbilly song written about Leo Minoza being trapped under the mountain. I'll play you a bit of that now just to give you an idea of the kind of hype and media bullshit that forms around this story.
We're coming, Leo. So Leo, don't despair. While you are in the cave and hoping, we are up above you groping, and we soon will make an opening.
Come on,
Leo. We're closer, Leo. And soon you'll breathe fresh air. While you are in the devil's prison, keep that spark of life a-fizzin'. We'll soon have you out of prison, Leo. Oh, Leo, Leo.
Don't play that one again, people, because it'll get stuck in your head. It's one of those horrible songs that's kind of an earworm, as the Germans say. And you can't get it out of your head once you get it stuck in there, and it's a horrible thing. Now, the story of the Big Carnival, a.k.a. Ace in the Hole, was based on a real-life event. Actually, a couple of real-life events. First one was a guy called Floyd Collins, which is he's name-checked a couple of times in this film, who in 1925 was trapped inside Sand Cave in Kentucky following a landslide. Louisville newspaper, the Courier Journal, jumped on the story, and a guy called William Burke Miller was the reporter on the scene. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of this. Unfortunately, Floyd Collins died before they could get him out. They dug a side tunnel to try to get to him, but the tunnel they dug came up close to his head, whereas the problem was one of his feet inside the tunnel was trapped by a rock. So, unfortunately, he did die, and he was buried there. They couldn't, it was too dangerous to try to retrieve the body, so they just basically sealed up the cave. And there was another one in 1949. A three-year-old kid called Kathy Fiscus in San Marino, California, fell into an abandoned well. And there was a rescue operation lasting several days, and there were thousands of people there to watch the action unfold. Unfortunately, the kid died as well, so basically it's a kind of media event which treats the people who are watching the events unroll as kind of vultures circling a soon-to-be-dead person. It really is. It's very classic Billy Wilder in the sense that it condemns the worst aspects of human nature that are brought out by certain kinds of journalism. I mean, there's a kind of journalism that uplifts, and there's a kind of journalism that really does encourage people, the worst aspects of people's personalities. I saw a case of that today. There's an Australian guy called David Hicks who was imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay. He was a bit wrong-headed. He got involved with the Taliban, never did anything at all to damage anyone, and was in Guantanamo for 5 years. And there was a story in the paper just today about how he's getting his life back together after he was released, that no charges were ever laid against him. But there was this kind of uplifting story about the fact that he's been released and he's been working, and he's actually managing a garden centre now. Hasn't done anything wrong since he got back. And he's married, he's settled down, he's moving on with his life. And I kind of like that story, because while there's been a lot of sensational journalism about Guantanamo, I like the story of a man who, yeah, made a big mistake and did something really stupid, but has kind of got his life turned around. And that's one side of journalism. And this kind of sensationalist bullshit is the other side. And, of course, Billy Wilder, who had seen his share of stupidity and human ugliness in his life. Of course, he grew up in Germany and moved to the States when Hitler was in ascendancy. And Billy Wilder had this beautiful acid cynicism about things that other people tended to just accept as a part of life. The movie, there's actually a lawsuit about the movie. A screenwriter called Victor Desney claimed that he had contacted Wilder's secretary and proposed a film based on the story of Floyd Collins sometime in 1949. Wilder eventually settled the law case in 1956 for about $14,000. But there's nothing new in Hollywood. I mean, that kind of thing goes on these days, where the big gun lawyers try to protect the studio and the studio properties against people who claim that they originally had the story. So I think arguably this is one of Kirk Douglas's better roles. I've seen him be very bad in movies, but I've also seen him be excellent. I think this is one of the excellent ones. The 50s were a great decade for Kirk Douglas in film, though his kind of peak decade ending in about 1962 with 2 Weeks in Another Town. Jan Sterling, fantastic. Bleach blonde, cynical, looking after herself, really greedy. And this is another one of those films. It's the dark side of the American dream. Basically, making money and improving your own lot is supposed to be a virtue in the classic American dream. But this one, the way by which Mrs. Minoza in particular makes her money during the course of the film, with everybody moving in and circling the corpse in a sense, shows the dark side of that. There are certain ways to do things and certain ways not to do things. And this film is a gut punch. It really it kind of parallels the ultimate fate of Chuck Tatum. It's I'm not going to say any more than that, but if you know how the film ends, you'll know what I mean by that. It really does have a serious condemnation of media as a force for evil in the world. It's a very good companion piece to another movie I've covered on Paleo Cinema Podcast, being A Face in the Crowd, the Andy Griffith movie written by Bud Schulberg from about 1957, I think it is. So, you know, basically, in spite of censorship, in spite of the studio system and all of that, there were times and specific movies that really did question a lot of the things that, in particular, some studios didn't particularly like them to question. There's a beautiful history of dissent in spite of censorship, in spite of blacklists, in spite of all that bullshit that went on at the time. There's a beautiful history of dissent in Hollywood cinema. Not on a percentage basis large, but the films that really do go out there and really do take a chance and really do speak truth to the popcorn masses are films that are now being really appreciated. They're the ones that people are watching, that film buffs really appreciate. And I think that Ace in the Hole, The Big Carnival, is definitely one of those films that is, yeah, it's sensationalist and it's bombastic and it's over the top and it's larger than life in some ways. But I think if you're going to do that sort of thing in a film, you really do have to have a message. It doesn't have to be a beat over the head message, but it has to be like a part of it. Has to be woven into the thread of the story, and I think in this case it very much is. It's one of the best films of its age in a lot of ways. There was so much else that came out that could have been this kind of film, but chickened out on it. But this particular one, I can't see anywhere in this film where they shied away from a gut punch when a gut punch was called for. And for that reason, if nothing else, apart from the other virtues the film has, and the stark black and white photography is definitely one of the virtues of this film. I can't see a reason where, I can't see a place where this film cops out. And in the 1950s, in the studio system in Hollywood, that is a hell of an achievement. And that's the kind of thing that Billy Wilder at his best did. So I'm going to take another break now, and then I'm going to get stuck into the second film I'm going to talk about, 1971 British crime drama Villain, starring Richard Burton, Ian McShane, and Nigel Davenport.
She comes off like a rose, and everybody knows she'll get you in Dodge. Well, you can look, but you better not. Poison. Man, she's crazy. She'll really do you in if you let her get under your skin. Poison ivy, poison ivy. Think at night while you sleep, poison ivy comes a cure. Now measles make you bumpy, and mumps will make you lumpy, and chicken pox will make like a hound. The minute she starts to mess around, poison ivy, poison ivy. Late at night while you're sleeping, poison ivy comes a poison ivy.
lotion. You'll be scratching like a hound the minute she starts to mess around. Poison ivy, poison ivy.
That was classic Australian 1960s band Billy Thorpe and the Aztecs with their version of Poison Ivy, which is like an Australian classic. Moving right along to the second film we're going to talk about today, the 1971 crime drama Villain. Okay, I'm going to read the synopsis from Wikipedia and try to paraphrase it, because like all synopses from Wikipedia that I have for films that I do, there are syntax errors in it. Okay, this film tells the story of ruthless East End gangster Vic Dakin and his plans for an ambitious raid on the wages van of a plastics factory. This is a departure from Dakin's usual modus operandi, and the job is further complicated by his having to work with fellow gangster Frank Fletcher's firm. Try saying that fast. As Dakin plots, his lover Wolf wheels and deals, and British MP Draycott gets caught up in the web of his own iniquity. They are doggedly pursued by Inspector Bob Matthews, Nigel Davenport, who's just waiting for Dakin to slip up. The film was written by the unusual combination of well-known British comedy television writers Dick Clement and Ian LaFrenay, and the American actor Al Lettieri, who was in The Godfather and The Getaway and Mr. Majestic. So, basically, that's the story of the film. It's about Vic Dakin, who is based on Ronnie Cray, one of the Cray brothers, who were big-time gangsters in London in the 1960s. They were twins, and they kind of owned some clubs and things like that, and they kind of mingled with medium-level celebrities in London at the time, so the story of the Cray brothers is well-known. In fact, there was a movie made about them in the 1990s, and like Ronnie Cray, Vic Dakin is a homosexual, though there is some evidence that Ronnie was bisexual, and his lover Wolfie, played by Ian McShane, gets involved in his crime stuff. Now, this movie really got kicked in the ass at the time it came out for a couple of reasons, homophobia being one of them, and there'd been an unsuccessful movie that Richard Burton starred in as a homosexual character before this, a movie called Staircase, based on a two-handed play. He did this in he did that one in 1969. Co-starred Rex Harrison. What am I saying? Richard Harrison. Rex Harrison. And it was about a couple of aging homosexual hairdressers and how they handle getting older in a society that that kind of condemns who they are. That movie has since been adopted as a positive thing by a number of gay film critics. I haven't seen it for a very long time. I saw it ages ago. But the odd thing about it is this is another role 2 years later where Richard Burton plays a homosexual character. In both films, his mother's played by an actress called Kathleen Nisbet. And in this film, it kind of has some parallels with White Heat, the James Cagney movie from the 1940s. There's that kind of mother-love thing and that kind of neurosis about Vic Dakin. They're very much kind of parallels. Cody Jarrett, the character that Cagney played in White Heat, so there are some parallels that have been made by various people about that at the time. Ian McShane did an interview where he talked about this film fairly recently for the Daily Mail in England. He said he had mixed feelings about playing Richard Burton's bisexual lover. And there are some scenes that were actually filmed that were never fully, that were never put into the film, particularly a love scene between Vic Dakin and Wolfie. There are some scenes where they are together, but there are no sort of physically demonstrative scenes in it, in a positive way. But there were some scenes filmed where McShane and Burton kissed. And McShane said, after kissing me, he was going to beat the hell out of me. And it was that kind of relationship, rather hostile. It was very S&M. It wasn't shown in the film. Burton said to me, I'm very glad you're doing this film. And McShane said, "So am I, Richard." And he said, "You know why, don't you?" And then McShane said, "Why?" Burton said, "You remind me of Elizabeth." And McShane laughed and then said, "I guess that made the kissing easier." Of course, that's a reference to Elizabeth Taylor, who was married to Richard Burton at the time. And they kind of went to each other's filming locations to a large extent wherever they possibly could. In fact, there are some scenes, you know, of the film that were filmed in a pub, the Assembly House pub in Kentish Town. And they were filming in the pub, and in between takes, Elizabeth Taylor would get behind the bar and pull pints for the cast and crew. I don't think she'd do that kind of thing now. Apparently her health hasn't been very good, but that was the kind of thing she was doing in those days. And was kind of supportive of Burton in this film. So it's a bit of a shame that the scene between Richard Burton and Ian McShane, that the kind of more intimate scene, isn't shown in the film, because I think it would have kind of fleshed out the character. I mean, there's no doubt that the character that Burton plays in this film is incredibly vivid. In fact, I'll pause there, and I'll play a little bit of audio from the film just to give you an idea about the character, and then I'll come back and talk to you about why I find this film so interesting.
Fancy living here.
Oh, nice and quiet.
Stupid punters. Telly all the week, screw the wife on Saturday.
That was Dakin talking about the area where they're going to do the robbery for the plastics factory, which is kind of out in the burbs a bit. The next bit is Vic Dakin convincing Frank Fletcher, the character played in this film by T.K. McKenna, that they should go and do the robbery, even though it's outside the comfort zone, it's outside what they usually do as criminals. Here he is kind of seducing him into going along with the robbery, because the place where they're going to do the robbery is on Fletcher's patch. It's not in Dakin's patch, and he needs to get Fletcher's cooperation to go ahead and do the job.
Us? Come on, Vic, come on. We don't crap on our own hands.
Frank, we doing all right, aren't we? We both kings of our castles, aren't we? You got that little semi-yard in Epsom. But you won't keep it if you sit on your ass in front of the telly, delegating. If it's big enough and good enough, you do it yourself. Because you know why? Because nobody else can do it better.
And here's a bit where Dakin confronts Matthews, the copper, played by Nigel Davenport, in a men's room in one of the clubs. He's just kind of monstered the MP who... played by Donald Sinden, an actor who's more known for light comedy roles than this one, where he plays a kind of horny politician who gets involved with criminals and gets blackmailed by Dakin into providing him with an alibi for the crime. But here's the bit between Dakin and Matthews, and to be honest with you, Nigel Davenport holds his own against Richard Burton in this scene. I quite like any of the scenes they have together. They work quite well as actors together.
So what's he doing here? He's an MP, isn't he? I mean, the whole country looks up to him, right? So what's he doing here? Gambling, hauling, boozing. Can't even wash his hands when he goes to the ball. Makes you think, doesn't it?
Why did your firm cut up Bennett Thompson?
Who's he?
I don't know what you were hoping to achieve, except perhaps an orgasm.
Don't be a burglar all your life. Take a day off, Sergeant.
Inspector.
Oh, it's come through, has it? That's nice. Bit more on your widow's pension.
Richard Burton copped a lot of shit for this film at the time that it came out, for a couple of reasons, one of which is people said that his Cockney accent wasn't very good. But I kind of I watched the film listening for that, because I'd heard about the criticism. And to be honest with you, I think it kind of works because there's a certain kind of criminal who tries to lose an accent as they become successful. They try to kind of mainstream and upmarket their voice as a way of proving that they're of a certain social standing. And I think that the way that Burton speaks as Dakin has an aspect of that to it. People did complain because they were used to Richard Burton doing the great big Shakespearean round-toned kind of speech, and his mellifluous voice was a trademark for him to a certain extent. And people expected that. When they saw Richard Burton in a film, they expected to get those kind of theatrical tones to his voice. And he doesn't really do that in this film. And I think that the fact that he played two homosexual roles in a relatively short period of time kind of threatened some people. They felt that it was wrong in some way. Some people thought that Richard Burton, who was known to be quite a significant coxman and ladies' man at the time and subsequently and before, it was outside their comfort zone to see him playing a character who was, by their lights, less than masculine. But of course, that's not the case. It kind of talks more about the time in which this film was made than his choices as an actor to make the film. And I think that it works really well. It's a hard film. It's a tough film. There's a lot of hard violence in it, not all of which is physical either. There's some tough psychological violence in it, particularly in the relationship between McShane's character, Wolfie, and Vic Dakin. And, of course, the robbery scene, which it's a totally fucked up robbery. Apart from anything else, there's a classic Jaguar that's almost wrecked during the filming of the thing. And because it is outside their comfort zone, and because the job is rushed by the fact there's going to be a strike soon, and the company is buying an armoured car, which makes the robbery that much more difficult, the job's rushed by Dakin and Fletcher, and basically fucked up to a big extent. And it's a great way. It's filmed beautifully. I mean, the film, particularly the action scenes, are filmed really, really well. There's a lot of thought gone into them, and just the errors made by the criminals, one of which ultimately leads to the cops pursuing Dakin and his mob for this. It's shown very well. It's a hard, gritty film. It's not filmed in summertime. It's filmed in that kind of grey, not quite winter. It could be spring, could be autumn in London, where the skies can be grey and everybody's wearing coats and gloves. And basically, the whole milieu isn't bright, sunny London the way you see in a lot of other films. It is that kind of gritty 1960s London, 1970s London. That fits the kind of film this is. The acting, apart from Davenport and Burton, is fantastic. Ian McShane's great as Wolfie, who, amongst his other sidelines, procures girls for rich politicians, and one of the girls, of course, being Fiona Lewis, an actress who had a career in the 70s and 80s, and who, to be totally sexist about this, looked good naked. Very attractive women. There's another scene in a strip club as well, where they've got a blonde stripper doing a hula dance with a grass skirt on, which I found quite of interest. And, quite cute she was. So, yeah, there's violence, there's sex, there's good dialogue. And it's just the movie was, as I said, really criticised at the time for a number of sociological reasons. They didn't think that Burton sounded right for the Dakin character. They didn't think that it was right that he was playing a homosexual character. And people, of course, felt threatened by that. But on further reflection, like The Big Carnival / Ace in the Hole, this is another film that looks better after the time at which it was made, upon like reflection and upon the changes in society. It holds up better now, perhaps, than it did at the time. Though there were supporters for it at the time, and it didn't make money. It wasn't an incredibly successful film at the time, but there have been lists made since of good British crime films, and this one always sits up there. It's got a certain... It's grounded by the locations. It's grounded by the acting and the choices made by Michael Tuckner, the director, that makes it a really valid crime drama. It does have its influences, White Heat, amongst other things. But I do like Burton in this film. He's solid. I mean, he was never a particularly tall or particularly muscular actor, but he was an actor who could act muscular. And he's sort of sociopathic, needy, and incredibly violent Vic Dakin is an honourable piece of acting. I don't mind the accent. I don't mind the fact there's Richard Burton playing the role. I found him incredibly believable as Vic Dakin, even though I'd seen him doing everything from The Night of the Iguana to Cleopatra and other roles in those sorts of films in the past. It's I first saw this film at an age, I think I did see it in the 70s, when maybe my understanding of homosexuality wasn't what it is now. Of course, this was before I met any gay people that I knew were gay. And I had the usual teenage homophobia that a lot of people have. It wasn't until I met gay people and some gay people were incredibly generous to me in spite of the chip I had on my shoulder that I kind of moved away from that. So when I hear teenage people mouthing off about anti-gay stuff now, I know it, they're speaking out of ignorance, as I did at the time. And so, of course, seeing the film now, I have more of an understanding of homosexuality, and while not at all condoning any action that Vic Dakin takes anywhere in this film, I think that I'm more accepting of the character that Richard Burton plays in this film than I was when I originally did see the film. So that's about all I want to say about Villain. I know that Zom's seen it and he likes the film, so I'm sure he's going to have a couple of things to say. And when I get back from another break now, I'm going to do the voicemails, and I got one email as well. So another break, and then I'll get into that.
What's Dakin doing, apart from carving up croupiers?
Huh? I don't know, do I? When do I see Dakin?
You pay a protection, buddy.
He's a nutter.
He's a psychopath.
A few years ago, when he was small time, just a minder down the bush, do you know what he done? He tied a Maltese bonce to a lamppost, cut off his...
Yes, I know.
Okay, we've got one email and a few voicemails. I'll read the email first. It's from our old friend David Munn. He says, "Hi Terry, I love the music show. So much great music I'd never heard before. I really have to try to find a rip of the Freddy and the Dreamers album online. Winnie the Pooh was addictive, and I'm a big Disney fan. A more recent Disney covers album, which was really good, was Stay Awake, which contained artists like Tom Waits, Aaron Neville, and Sun Ra doing songs from Disney movies and TV shows. I'm also a fan of the soundtracks of the AIP Beach Party movies featuring ex-Disney girl Annette Funicello. I've got a suggestion for a song that would be perfect for a future show. Have you heard Jack Palance's song, The Meanest Man Who Ever Lived? It's a lot of fun. He actually did a whole album of country songs, but I haven't heard any of the rest. I first heard the song on the Movies About Girls podcast, which I highly recommend, even if a weekly 4.5-hour podcast is a bit much to listen to regularly. Well, I'm off to the Melbourne Film Festival in a little over a week. I'll attach my booking sheet so you can see what I'm planning to see. Hopefully I'm able to squeeze in a few more too. Cheers, David." Thank you, David. Yeah, I'm not getting to Melbourne International Film Festival. In fact, I've never been to the Melbourne International Film Festival. I have, however, been to the Melbourne Underground Film Festival, MUFF, which is pretty cool. It's a little bit eclectic and it's in small venues, and it usually follows soon after MIFF, the Melbourne International Film Festival. But yeah, I hope you enjoy it. As for the Jack Palance song, I'm going to have to find that. Definitely going to. We'll work out. I'll send you a link or something like that to the Winnie the Pooh one for your things. Yeah, Beach Party movies. Yeah, they're pretty much fun too. There's actually a cameo by Vincent Price in one. I think Buster Keaton appeared in another one. So they're definitely light, frothy fun. I'm actually a bit of a fan of Back to the Beach 2, the 1980s one, where Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello come back, and they're amongst other people. There's Pee Wee Herman in it, and Connie Stevens is in it, and a bunch of other people, which is always a bit of fun. It was actually directed by an Australian woman called Lyndall Hobbs, who for a time, I believe, was Al Pacino's girlfriend. But thanks for that one, David. Yeah, enjoy the film festival, and if you've got any recommendations after you go, drop me a voicemail or drop me an email, let me know, and I'll pass them along through the podcast. Always happy to do that. Now, we also have some voicemails. The first one And I think one of the more interesting ones is from our old friend Zom.
Paleo, paleo cinema. Paleo, paleo cinema. I'ma listen to a paleo cinema and I'm gonna leave the feedback now. I just got out of my bed and rolled off of a big fat cow. It's paleo, paleo cinema time with Dr. Zom. Hello, this is Dr. Zom, and I'm calling to leave a little feedback for my main man, baby, Terry, at the Paleo Cinema, and the movies that I want to discuss with you, Terry, is from your neck of the woods, Daddy, and it's called Stone from 1974. I've been wanting to see this movie for a long time and finally got an opportunity to check out Stone. And to my surprise, who did I see in Stone but the toe cutter from Mad Max? Yeah, baby. And you know that Dr. Zom loves the toe cutter, baby. Well, anyway, the toe cutter steals this movie like only he can. He doesn't have Johnny the Boy in this, you know, fixing his hair for him and, you know, taking care of business behind the scenes, Daddy. But he does have a French kiss with another dude, and he is big, he is hairy, and he is the man who is the real, true charisma behind the Gravedigger motorcycle gang, baby. This movie fucking rocked, and I am a biker myself, and I like the fact that as the Harley guys or the Triumph guys or whoever in the movie, the other gang of the Blackbirds, said that the Gravediggers rode Jap crap. Well, guess what, baby? Dr. Zom rides Jap crap too, Daddy. So anyway, this movie fucking was good. Top to bottom, I couldn't find any flaws in it. I even liked Stone, who looked like an Aussie version of Michael Landon, kind of. Had some hot chicks in it who were au naturel, if you will, with the hair down under. And the real boobies, too, which Dr. Zom likes. Lots of violence, lots of great motorcycle stunts and riding. Hot bikes, hot chicks, dirty dudes kicking each other's ass and having a fun time doing it. And let me tell you something, baby. This movie was very, very realistic as far as the motorcycle MCs go, as everything goes and out there just having fun. But I had to call my main man, Terry Frost, and let him know what Dr. Zom thought of Stone. Zom.
Whoop. Thank you for that, Zom. It's not often I get guys singing to me. Stone, I talked about that in a very early Paleo Cinema podcast. I think it may have been the second one around. And, yeah, it is rock solid. They did get a lot of cooperation from a lot of the motorcycle groups around Sydney at the time. And, yes, Hugh Keysburn is a cult movie god in Australia. The other guy in that film who's a bit of a cult movie god too is Vincent Gill, who played the kind of priesty kind of character for the motorcycle gang in Stone. And, yeah, a lot of those guys still get together and do a motorbike ride together basically every year. Sandy Harbert, I know, still rides a motorbike, amongst others. Bindi Williams, the Aboriginal character in the film, still does. If you get the DVD, there's a lot of extras on there, which includes some interviews with a lot of the actors. And it may be worth tracking down. So, yeah, definitely Australian cult film. It's a good companion piece to another Australian cult film, which has a nude scene by the same one of the same actresses, Rebecca Gilling, in it. And that being, of course, The Man from Hong Kong. But thank you for the feedback, Zom. Yeah, definitely a fantastic piece of exploitation cinema, Stone, and I recommend that anybody see it. It's I can't really think of a podcaster or a podcast fan that I know that wouldn't get something out of it. So always appreciate your feedback. You can sing whenever you like on this podcast. Just keep the feedback coming, mate. And moving along, I've now got another piece of audio feedback, a couple of them from Rupert, who had some problems with remembering what I'd actually said and what I hadn't said. So don't particularly worry about that, Rupert, because it's a problem that I have myself.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert. Just wanted to say a quick thank you very much for your mentioning my Gentleman's Guide interviews on this week's Paleo Cinema. It was very kind of you. I hope you liked the Dante interview. I didn't get to talk to him as much about Matinee as more about a couple other films like Explorers and The Burbs. He does do a cool interview with DVD savant Glenn Erickson about the DVD release of Matinee that is interesting, that people should go check out at dvdsavant.com. But I was going to say, your mentioning of Assault on a Queen, which I've never seen, but I meant to, and the Duke Ellington score made me think of another score that I was reminded of recently, another blog that I really like, Mr. Peel's Sardine Liqueur, one of my favorite film blogs. He mentioned Frankenheimer's 99 and 44 over 100% Dead. I don't even know if that's how you say it, but in the past month or so, and talked about the score. So I tracked it down, and it's a really great jazzy score. I think, is it Schifrin? It's Henry Mancini, my bad, I believe. And well worth, I'm sure you already have it, but if you didn't, well worth tracking down. I got to track down the Duke Ellington Assault on a Queen score now after hearing you talk about it. Anyway, good stuff as always, sir. We'll talk to you later. Hey, Terry, Rupert, one more time. Sorry, I just listening to the end of this week's show realized that I already had left you a message about 99 and 44, 100% Dead. And so I apologize for the sort of double message. My brain is not fully functioning at this point, and I had forgotten. But I think I just thought of you so specifically when I was listening to that score. It reminded me of the kind of stuff you play on your show and stuff like that. And the movie itself was very much in the vein of stuff you've covered. So like, it's cool that you said that you might cover it at some point. I'm definitely looking forward to that. But anyway, sorry that I sound like an idiot for calling in twice like I hadn't already talked about that movie. I just had forgotten. I tweeted to you about this, but just wondered if you could go through a couple of your favorite, and you said you liked the early Corman stuff. I just saw Attack of the Crab Monsters for the first time, and just wondered if you could talk about some of the early ones that you like, or just any Corman-directed films in general that you like. I'm very curious. I think you've talked about a few on your show, but always love to hear favorites. So thanks again, sir. Good stuff as always.
Thanks, Rupert. For a start, mate, you never sound stupid. I'd rather get two voicemails with the same thing in them than none at all. So if you repeat yourself, not particularly an issue for me. And to me, it doesn't sound stupid at all. So thank you. And if you get any more interviews that go on to Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, I'll definitely be listening to them. You did great with Dante. You did great with Alan Arkush as well. I believe that Joe Dante may be turning up at the Melbourne International Film Festival. I'm not sure, but I think that Ben from Cine Coltania tweeted about it recently, that he was seeing something about Joe Dante. So that'd be interesting. I probably won't get to that, but I think it's kind of cool that he's getting recognized for that. As for early Cormans, I definitely like the Poe adaptations he did with Vincent Price. I think they're very cool. I like the original Little Shop of Horrors, and pretty much anything with Dick Miller in it is good. Of later Corman stuff, I kind of like Frankenstein Unbound, the adaptation of Brian Aldiss's novel that he did with Raoul Julia in it. A lot of people don't like that film, but I'm quite fond of it. I liked the novel originally, and though the film does stray a lot from the novel, I do like it. I do like the audacity of it. But I think, and you know, any Raoul Julia movie is better than no Raoul Julia movie. And so, and anything in between too. I think the Corman is finally getting the recognition that he deserves for what he did on some incredibly small budgets. I believe that he's doing a, he's directed a film recently called Sharktopus for the Sci-Fi Channel. And I definitely know that Sally wants to see that one. She's seen the trailer for it. And being the big fan of bad CGI monster movies that she is, Sharktopus is definitely on her download list. And it is nice to see Corman doing another film. Even, you know, he doesn't have to do a lot of them. The guy has racked up a few birthdays now. But he's definitely a very important filmmaker, if for nothing else than the support and encouragement he gave people like Francis Ford Coppola and Marty Scorsese and Ron Howard and who knows how many other filmmakers, Alan Arkush amongst others. And I'm not sure about, maybe Joe Dante, I'm not entirely sure about that. But yeah, maybe I should do some Corman films. Did Corman do Mask of the Red Death with Vincent Price, or was that someone else? I'll look it up later. But anyway, I like Mask of the Red Death as well. So thank you for that. I did get another email, another voicemail from, well, I kept saying email, don't I? I did get another voicemail from Rupert as well. It seemed to cut out at the end, but he does have a little bit to say about Hickey and Boggs, the film that I covered in the last podcast that I did that was actually movies, not music.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert. Just calling to talk about Hickey and Boggs, and wanted to say I love that you're covering that movie. It's a favorite of mine, and one that doesn't get talked about enough. And I agree, it's one of the great underrated crime films. I think maybe you said of the 70s, or I really like it a lot. I wish it was more available in a better edition, it's really too bad.
That's all I got of that one. So thanks for that, Rupert. Even a little scrap of your stuff is always interesting. Appreciate that. So didn't get much else, but again, Paleo Cinema lowercase no dash at Skype. You can leave me a voicemail there, or you can do it at the voicemail number, which is right at the top of the podcast webpage. Before I go, I just want to give a name check and thanks to the other podcasts around that I listen to. Metal Mikey at Action Attraction, Vince over at B-MovieCast, Vince and Nick over at B-MovieCast. There's a new one too, which is a local one. Grant Watson here in Australia does a movie podcast now called Bad Film Diaries, and you can find that on iTunes or just do a bit of a Google search for it, where he's talking about films. His most recent one, he talks about two interesting films. He talks about Predators and Figures in a Landscape, the Joseph Losey film starring Malcolm McDowell and Robert Shaw. So give him a bit of love. Give it a go. He'd be fine. Cine Coltania, I wish you guys were back doing stuff. Cinema Diabolica, I like. The Girls over at Galactic Suburbia, even though it's not a movie podcast. And I shouldn't really say girls, I should say women, so I apologise for that. It's a podcast about science fiction and fantasy publishing in Australia. Rachin and her cohorts over at GOF Radio, Girls on Film Radio. Mail Order Zombie, Brother D and Ms. Brenn over there. Let's see who else we got. And of course, I can't go without thanking and giving all the best to the guys over at Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, Sam and Big William. Love your stuff, guys. Listen to podcasts, people, not just mine. Listen to anything you can get your hands on. Work out what you love. Give feedback and love to the podcast that you enjoy. And this particular one will be back in 3 weeks. I may do, and I've said this before, but sometimes I don't end up doing what I say I'm going to do. I may do The Bride Wore Black, starring Jean Moreau. And I may even have a look at the one Rupert suggests, and given the fact that he's mentioned it a couple of times, I'm happy to. 99 and 44, 100th% Dead, starring Richard Harris, Chuck Connors, and I think Anne Turkel. Anyway, enjoy your movie viewing over the next 3 weeks. Take care of yourselves. Everyone be safe and well. And I know there are a couple of people out there that have got a few problems. You'll get through them. Just look to the other side of them. You'll get through them. So take care of yourselves, and I'll be back soon. Bye.
The party's over now. The dawn is drawing very nigh. Let's creep away from the day and allow me to say goodbye.